Support for the Exchange Podcast comes from you, our sustaining members, and from New Hampshire School Administrators Association, representing school superintendents and administrators, championing the education of children in our state every day since 1941. In today's ever-changing world, public education matters, and so does its leaders. Online at nhsaa.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Concerns rise in New Hampshire over the coronavirus, and this hour we'll speak with Manchester Mayor Joyce Craig about the city's plan for the possible arrival of COVID-19 in Manchester. We'll also talk with her about a variety of other issues facing the city, and we will speak with Sierra Hubbard of the Keene Sentinel about what cuts to Monadnock United Way mean for nonprofits in the region. If you have questions or comments about these stories or other things in the news, send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, or call. We'd love to hear your voice on this program today, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. We're going to start the program talking with Mayor Joyce Craig about the coronavirus and its possible arrival in Manchester. And the mayor is with me now. Welcome. Thank you very much for being here. So you were sworn into your second term in January. We're happy to have you here to talk about this public health issue. New Hampshire health officials have confirmed two cases of COVID-19 in New Hampshire, neither of which are in Manchester.
Correct.
So good to point that out. But the city is keeping an eye on it. Can you describe for us what the city is doing to prepare for COVID-19?
Sure. And, you know, I think it is important to say that nothing is happening in Manchester at this point in time. But we are certainly, you know, hoping for the best, but preparing for the worst. And it's something that our health department, our fire department, our police department have been doing all along. But we have enacted our emergency operations center for effective and efficient communications. We are working on a daily basis with the state, having conference calls. We had a meeting yesterday with all of our department heads in the city to ensure a continuity of government in the event that something should happen. In past years, you know, for example, our health department, the building they were in caught fire and was destroyed. So again, we have plans in place, but we just want to make sure people are cross-trained and have plans to ensure that we can continue providing the services that we need to our residents.
Can you tell us a little more about the Emergency Operations Center? What does that do? Who's involved with that?
Sure. It's, again, police, health, fire. We have representatives from the state. We have hospital representatives there, AMR, our emergency service. So everyone is, the school district, everyone is on the same page. You know, we have information coming in almost on an hourly basis. Things are changing, new information. And it's critical that we get that communication to all of those entities and then out to the public as well.
What do those updates look like if you're saying you get them so frequently?
Well, you know, so for example, yesterday we heard the information for students coming home from college, for example, how long the recommendation is for them to stay home for 2 weeks if they're coming from Italy. So it varies greatly, but it's information that's coming sporadically and ongoing. Information about the testing. Thankfully, it seems as though we're going to be getting more testing opportunities sent to us, where before it was limited at the hospitals.
So more testing possibly on the way.
Correct.
Yeah, okay. So what are you hearing from the state about the eventual arrival of COVID-19 in Manchester? Is the state considering it sort of an inevitability, like it's going to show up in Manchester?
We have not heard that. Again, our city is preparing like we do always for things like this and ensuring the public is safe.
Mm-hmm. And are you talking with other communities or healthcare organizations? And if so, what does that communication look like?
So I have not, but I'm sure our health department has. They're taking the lead on this, working directly with the state, and they're working with other communities.
Mm-hmm. And can you talk a little bit more about what you meant when you said continuity of government?
Sure. So, for example, this year, our city clerk's office was hit hard with the flu, and they were closed for 2 days. And if that happens with the coronavirus, we want to make sure that we are continuing to do what we need to do for our community. If we have people that can't come into the office, we need to ensure that people can still pay their taxes, can still get a marriage license, and do business like they need to within the city. So, again, it's cross-training, utilizing online as much as we can, and making sure that our infrastructure can support that.
I see. So are city employees able to some extent, work from home if they need to?
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay. Well, listeners, we're going to move on for just a moment from the coronavirus, but if you do have questions for Mayor Craig about how the city is preparing, if you have questions maybe pertaining to the schools, let us know. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We'll revisit the conversation if you have a question about it. But I do want to ask about other things pertaining to Manchester, Mayor Craig. You've been a couple of months into your second term. So what are the top few challenges that you are now facing in your new term?
So, you know, we're in a great position in the city right now. We've accomplished an awful lot over the last couple of years. And I really feel like things are coming together. So we can use the school district, for example. We have a number of new school board members. We have a great new superintendent with a vision. And we have the plan from Manchester Proud, who has been working over 2 years engaging the community on what they want to see in our public schools. So everything is at a point right now where it can come together and we can start implementing great programs in our schools to ensure that our students are learning, our educators are in a place where they can provide the best education to our students and make sure that our schools are where they need to be.
Mm-hmm. So schools are certainly a huge topic. Did want to ask you about this because the school board approved a new strategic plan for the school system. So I wanted to ask you what you see as the highlights of this new vision for Manchester schools.
So the Manchester Proud plan is a roadmap, if you will, now for our school district. And it really focuses on growing our learners, growing our educators, and growing our system. For example, making sure that our kids have access to what they need to have access to. For years, our district didn't have a curriculum plan. We had sporadic curriculum throughout different schools. We'll focus on literacy this coming year. Our superintendent put forward his vision and his plan, which fits nicely with Manchester Proud's plan. He is putting forward 100% graduation rate. All students by third grade will be reading at grade level. And so what we need to do now as a school board is provide him with policy and make sure that we can get the students where they need to be.
Mm-hmm. And part of the plan, I think, was to make sure that you as mayor are not part of not the school board chair anymore, right?
So there's a governance portion to that. Mm-hmm. And they do suggest that the number of members on the school board decreases and that the mayor not be chairman of the school board, which honestly I agree with.
Why?
I have participated in a number of programs with other mayors throughout the country. I haven't met one who chairs the school board. And it takes a lot of time and a lot of focus. And for my purpose as chairman, what I get to do is chair the meeting and agree to the agenda. And then I get a vote like any other member of the school board. And so it's a very difficult position to be in. And it becomes political. And I really feel like the schools and the operation of the schools need to be policy driven and not political. And I'm thankful for the new board that we have right now because we were able to make changes on day one when they were during the inauguration, after the inauguration, so that it was clear that we are policy driven. We're not going to micromanage this school district, this superintendent. We've made some great strides moving in that direction.
Mm-hmm. So does this mean that you will be more hands-off?
It doesn't mean that I'll be more hands-off personally because it's education that got me involved in public service in the first place. And I truly believe that for a city to be successful and vibrant, we need a strong public school system. That is key to what we need to do in our city. So personally, I am going to be very involved in doing everything that I can to ensure our students and our educators get what they need to provide a quality education for Manchester.
Mm-hmm. So as far as I understand, some parts of this strategic plan involve one-time spending of up to $5 million. Is that correct? Is that number correct?
We have $5 million coming in from the state this next fiscal year. Mm-hmm. Yes. The plan from the superintendent will include that. A lot of it will go toward professional development, which we actually haven't had in our school district for many, many years.
Teacher trainings and whatnot?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Coordinated with new curriculum. So we have some professional development at the beginning and at the end of the year. But this is some serious professional development, 3 or 4 days. And then in addition to that, development on how to get your students more involved in the education process. So some quality information and training for our teachers, again, to make them better while they're in the classroom with our students.
Does any part of this plan require or encourage consolidation of schools, closing of schools that may be underutilized?
The plan from Manchester Proud did not. In Dr. Goldhart's plan, there's mention of, this is something that we need to address, and it certainly is.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And the school system is pretty diverse, right? I mean, the 13,000 students, the biggest one in the state, biggest school district in the state. Does this plan account for the diverse needs of different populations within Manchester? And if so, how?
It absolutely does. And, when we're talking about the schools, I have to take a step back and say I am a proud graduate of Manchester Public Schools. Two of my children have graduated, and I have a daughter who is a sophomore at Central High School. And I truly believe, again, in the value that we are providing to our students in the district. But we need to make sure that what we are doing is available and accessible to every student in Manchester. And I think that's something that both Manchester Proud and Dr. Goldhart have been very, very clear on. One of the goals that that I think that we will be able to achieve in this coming in next school year is ensuring that there are more students that have access to advanced placement courses. Dr. Goldhart is very clear in terms of his vision of we need to raise the bar and lower the barriers for all students. And I think that's something that our school board and the district is really focused on going forward.
Mm-hmm. We've heard a lot about Manchester Proud. This is a not a government organization, right? But a separate organization with community members coming together to sort of help form policy. One of the criticisms of Manchester Proud is that it's not a government agency, but it has an outsized influence. So I wanted to get you to respond to that.
So since day one, I've been encouraging our community to participate in all fronts of government. I go out into the community. I hold office hours. So that the fact that we had business leaders come forward and say our public schools are critical to the success of our city, I embraced that, and I think most of our community did. Based on the number of conversations they had, I believe it was over 5,000 conversations with individuals in our community. So I think it's a great thing that we had business leaders and community leaders come forward to help us put a strategic plan in place, again, based on community input. And it's something that we, the school district, wouldn't have been able to do otherwise. But now we have a roadmap based on community input, what our community wants from our public schools. And I'm extremely grateful for that.
Mm-hmm. Another criticism that some have levied is that the Manchester Proud's strategic plan, or the strategic plan, does not emphasize parental involvement or is not strong enough on that. I wanted to get your take on that as well.
Yeah, so it's not written in it. It will be a part of the final plan. But one of the things is that parental involvement was a huge component in drafting the plan. There's not a section written about parental involvement, but all of this, again, with the 5,000 people that they've talked to, they went to PTOs, PTGs, they had parents participate in this. So the whole plan was based on parental involvement.
Mm-hmm. Listeners, we're speaking with Manchester Mayor Joyce Craig about a variety of issues facing New Hampshire's largest city. And now is your chance to give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org. I want to get back to the costs for a moment. You said we've got one-time costs covered by an infusion from the state. Are there any long-term costs that the strategic plan will cause? And if so, is the city prepared to continue covering those costs?
So there are a number of things that we're thinking about as we move forward with our school district. One is moving fifth graders from the elementary schools into the middle schools, and that's going to be a cost, a fit-up cost. We have done that in one of our middle schools over on the west side. It's worked out extremely well. So now there's a plan in place to do it at the other middle schools happening over the next 2 to 3 years. So certainly, when we put our budget, when the superintendent puts his budget together, it's an annual budget. But he is thinking about what the needs are on an ongoing basis for future years. There's that. There's, again, professional development. There's conversation in terms of reallocating funds instead of increasing funds. But, you know, at this point in time for the next school year, there isn't an increase in funds.
Okay. Let's talk about teacher contract negotiations, because teachers have been working without a new contract since the middle of 2018. What's it going to take to hammer out a deal?
Well, right now, and I'm very grateful for this, the new school board voted on my recommendation to put negotiations, to put the superintendent in charge of negotiations, as well as an attorney who's been working on this. And it's my understanding that the conversations have been very productive and are going well. So I am extremely hopeful that we will have a contract soon for our educators in Manchester.
And for those who aren't totally familiar with the back and forth that's been going on, what are the sticking points?
You know, I think it's that we haven't had a contract for over 300 days and salaries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, making sure that our teachers are paid fairly. From our perspective, we want to ensure our teachers are paid, but we also have to ensure that it's sustainable from our side. So getting to that point where we're all in agreement on that.
Mm-hmm. So when do you think that there will be an agreement reached? Are you able to sort of project any kind of timeline on this?
I wish I could. I would say tomorrow.
I'm sure there are a lot of teachers waiting to figure out when this will be finalized.
We all are. But mm-hmm. but again, I just want to stress from everything that I've heard from the MEA leadership to the superintendent himself, the conversations have been productive. Things are going well and moving in the right direction. And I think this is the first time that we can say that. So I feel confident that we will have a contract soon.
A contract soon. Okay. Recently, Manchester's Board of Aldermen voted to support you in your effort to allow refugees to be resettled in Manchester. Why do you want to support the resettlement of refugees in Manchester?
I welcome the diversity that we have in our city. We have the people in Manchester, that's what makes our community. And I, along with the governor, felt that it was important that we continue to do that.
You mentioned the governor, because both the state and the city need to have explicit, I don't know if it's written, but definitely explicit permission for this to happen.
And that's new. And we did have to put it in writing. And it had to be both the governor and the mayor of communities, which I think is unfortunate. The immigrants and refugees that we have in Manchester have added so much to our community, both from the education perspective to the businesses that they've started. And we are a welcoming place. And as long as I'm mayor, we will continue being a welcoming community.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. You mentioned that was unfortunate. Why?
I just don't think that we should have to do that. I mean, it was never done before. And to add a level of bureaucracy into this was not necessary, in my opinion.
There was an economic argument that you and others have made for the refugees and they're coming here to Manchester. Can you spell out that argument?
Well, they've opened a number of small businesses in our community. And, you know, there's one that comes to mind immediately. Matpa is a restaurant right next door to City Hall, which we frequent often.
What kind of restaurant is that?
It's Middle Eastern. The gentleman who owns it, his name is Omar. He was in Manchester and New Hampshire for all of 3 months, opened up a restaurant, and it's very successful. That's one example of many in our community and many communities throughout the city where we've had individuals move from another country to come to our city, thankfully, and start businesses. They're providing jobs and opportunities for others to leave a productive, successful life. And I welcome that in my city.
How can you be sure, or can you be sure, that the refugees who come here are able to fill those job opportunities that Manchester businesses are looking to fill? Do they have the skills? Do they have the language skills?
We work with the International Institute and other organizations in our community. Welcoming Manchester is another organization where they meet on a monthly basis. They provide language services and other services. So we are fortunate in Manchester that we have nonprofits that work with individuals who need help. But I also have a group in Manchester who I work with that have the ins and outs of what's going on in the other communities in the city. So it's important for, I think, leadership to understand what the needs are so that we can make sure that we are building those bridges and to ensure that people have the training and the job opportunities that are available to them.
So you're not expecting refugees to sort of land here day one, day two, start applying for jobs. There are systems that help them
Absolutely.
Get into the economy here in Manchester. Okay. One of the arguments against supporting this move to allow refugees to be resettled here say that, you know, federal policy is not quite aligned yet with, I guess, it's not in harmony with what cities want. This person was arguing against, say, chain migration and other federal policies. So are there federal policies that if you could change, would love to see change because it would help Manchester?
Well, obviously, if we could provide more funding and more training to individuals coming into our community, that would be great. Ensure that they are set up for a longer period of time. That would be probably the most important thing to me. And when we're talking about this, too, I think it's important to note that the number of immigrants and refugees that are coming into our communities has decreased significantly. So when the governor and I approved this going forward for this year, we were talking all of 30 people, including children, was the estimate that we got coming into Manchester.
30 people.
30.
Okay. We got this question from Megan, who submitted it via Harkin.
Good morning. My name is Megan, and I am a resident of Manchester. I have a close connection to the immigrant and refugee population in New Hampshire through my work, and unfortunately have observed an increase in anti-immigrant and anti-refugee rhetoric in our community. So my question for Mayor Craig is, how will your office combat this rise in hate speech or acts of hate directed at our immigrant neighbors?
That's really unfortunate, and I hate to hear that. And, you know, we have, in the situation where we've seen hate crime happen in Manchester, have visited those communities and spoken to them. And that's what we do. You know, we don't stand for it. We have zero tolerance for it. I hate hearing that that's going on. We, again, work with these different communities. We'll visit the churches and make sure that they understand that our administration has zero tolerance for this. And anything that we can do to ensure that people are comfortable and feel welcome in Manchester is what we want to do.
What kind of conversations are you having with the Manchester Police Department about hate speech?
It's not coming from the Manchester Police Department. They are very well aware and have done a lot of training to ensure that they are working with the different groups in Manchester.
Listeners, we're speaking today with Manchester Mayor Joyce Craig about a variety of issues pertaining to the city of Manchester. If you've got questions or comments, send them by email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. When we come back, we'll speak a little bit with Mayor Joyce Craig about substance abuse and how the city is working to tackle that issue. Again, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or email exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
From the seacoast to the Upper Valley, Monadnock to the Great North Woods, NHPR covers the stories that impact your community to help you stay connected to what's happening in every corner of the state. I'm Annie Ropeek, a reporter here at NHPR, and when you give $10 a month as a sustainer, you'll help support a vital resource that is statewide, regional, and deeply New Hampshire. Give today at nhpr.org.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we're speaking with Manchester Mayor Joyce Craig. And we're going to spend some time talking about substance abuse and addiction treatment in Manchester. Listeners, if you've got questions about this or about something else pertaining to the city of Manchester, give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org. Mayor Craig, it was announced last month that Catholic Medical Center in Manchester will be taking over the doorway responsibilities of the state's opioid response plan. Can you explain what that means for those who need treatment?
Well, I think, first of all, I agree with that approach. The doorway in Manchester is the busiest doorway. We see an awful lot of people coming from throughout the state into Manchester. And I think it's critical that the entity that's running the doorway have relationships with others in that community. So I'm very confident in CMC's ability to do that. But what it should mean is that people now going to the doorway can get into the treatment that they need quicker than what they were prior to.
Mm-hmm. And for folks who may be unaware, doorway is a system where folks suffering from some kind of addiction or substance abuse problem can go to the doorway and be connected with services that would help them.
It's an access point.
Basically an access point, right. And Manchester's access point has been particularly busy because Manchester is the biggest city in the state, and it's a big area. The Greater Manchester area draws from other towns.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note that Manchester implemented a program called Safe Station when there was nothing else in the entire state. And so everybody was used to going to a fire station in Manchester to get help when they were suffering from an addiction. And then the governor put forward the doorway plan, which is another access point. So you've got the access point in Manchester at a fire station. You also have the access point at the doorway. You also have an access point at 211. So
the number you can call for.
Exactly.
Yes.
So there are a number of ways that people can get help. But I think because of what Manchester did with Safe Station, it's very, and they were very successful, right? People understand and want to go to a fire station because they trust the firemen.
Mm-hmm. So why do you think CMC would be better equipped to run the doorway?
Well, they're in the community. They're very familiar with the players, with the nonprofits, and they've got those relationships, which are really critical in terms of being able to work. I mean, collaboration is key in all of this. One of the things that we've done is we've, again, instituted our Emergency Operations Center focused around the opioid crisis and homelessness. So almost every 2 weeks now, we have a group that gets together at the fire station, city employees, again, representatives from the hospitals. The state is sitting at the table now. And we're talking about what we all are doing to help our most vulnerable population in Manchester, folks in Manchester that are not necessarily residents of Manchester, but people who are here looking for help.
Mm-hmm. Does Manchester have, maybe this is a silly question, you tell me, does Manchester have everything it needs to help people with substance abuse?
No, we don't. I don't think any community in New Hampshire has everything that they need to help. One of the key components here are respite beds. So people come into a doorway, they need help. And it may be in the middle of the night. They need to go somewhere to stay and be safe. So we need additional beds and an area for them to be. We also need more treatment beds. Mm-hmm. And we need it throughout the state. So it can't just be concentrated in Manchester. The doorway program was put in place so to ensure that people can stay in their home community or close to their home community where their supports are. But right now, when you look at the treatment beds or the emergency shelter beds, there are not many beds in other locations. And we really need to, from a state perspective, focus on that.
So realistically, how would you hope that the city gets to a point where it has enough of the treatment beds and the other things that you mentioned that the city needs?
Well, we need help from the state. And again, it's helping Manchester, but it's also helping other communities, and that will help Manchester. So we need to focus on the residents who are living in our city. And if other areas can build out and get the services that they need, again, to help people in the communities. The goal, again, is to keep people where their supports are, where their family is, where they can get the help, then that will help our city.
So what kind of conversations are you having with the state to encourage the state officials to provide the resources?
So every time that we have these emergency operations meetings, we have representatives from DHHS there. We talk about the hours of the doorway services. So in Manchester, they're open on the weekends. They're open longer hours. Safe Station's open 24 hours a day. We've been requesting that they open all the doorways 24 hours. That would help our community. We consistently ask for more emergency shelter beds throughout the state. What we were just talking about are my asks to the state.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the business climate, and want to start with one specific story that folks may have seen in the Union Leader. Officials at Manchester Boston Regional Airport are looking at 14 years of declines of passengers through Manchester Boston Airport. They want to reverse that. To what extent does the decline in passengers impact Manchester and Manchester's economy?
Well, certainly the airport is a huge economic engine for the entire state. We have a relatively new airport director there who has done an amazing job with looking at things differently and ensuring we have new business there. So we have seen expanded service to airports, flights to Washington Dulles and Chicago O'Hare. The new airport director took a look at our debt service at the airport and was able to really do something that no one else has done at that airport and was able to bring our cost per employment down, which will make our airport now more competitive in terms of attracting other airlines to Manchester. And one thing I have to say is we consistently hear from individuals who say, I want more direct flights and cheaper flights. But it's a bit of a catch-22, right? Because if we can't show that people will fly out of our airport, it's hard for us to get other airlines here. So we need people to fly out of Manchester-Boston Regional Airport and to think about flights if you have a connection. We want individuals to think about their travel plans from the time that they leave their door. So do you want to go through the Boston traffic and take all that time to get to the airport and have a direct flight when potentially a layover would take less time and be less stressful, and it's much cheaper to park at Manchester, Boston.
Mm-hmm. Aside from the airport, though, the economy of Manchester, I don't know how you would describe it. I mean, you've mentioned on this program previously about, you know, BAE expanding, hospitals expanding. Can you talk a little bit about the economy as a whole?
Yeah, it's really exciting in our city right now. In addition to what you mentioned, we have a couple new hotels going up. We've got new living situations being built. We're really pleased with what's going on in our city. Last year, we applied for the federal build grant, which would have brought $25 million potentially into our city. Unfortunately, we didn't get that. It was the first time we applied, and typically first time applicants do not receive it, but we
are. So you'll try again.
We are. And our board voted on that last meeting, so I'm excited about that. It really takes a look at the South Commercial Street, South Elm Street area, which is prime for development, transportation, rail, pedestrian, biking, you know. So it's really an exciting time in the city of Manchester from an economic development perspective.
Which of those projects, or is there another project that you are particularly excited about?
You know, Liz Hitchcock is redeveloping one of the last mills in the city, and that's over in the South Willow area. And so that's an exciting project. It's focused on entrepreneurs and artists, and they would be able to actually live and show their work in the same space. And so that's a really exciting opportunity in the city as well.
We got this note from Brittany, who wrote to ask, how do you plan to address the homeless encampments and the potential for increased loitering in city parks this spring and summer?
So there's an ordinance in the city. You cannot camp in a city park. So we need to enforce the ordinances that we have in place. It is not illegal for panhandling in any community. But what we want to make sure is that people feel safe in Manchester. We've increased police patrol in our downtown. We've increased the complement. 15 officers last year. We're increasing it another 10 officers next fiscal year. We have a welcome center in our downtown right near Veterans Park. We have just approved putting a police substation there. So again, there'll be more of a presence for police in our downtown.
Mm-hmm. And the questioner may also want to know exactly if there are enough places for people to go at night.
There are not.
They're not.
We have one shelter in Manchester, one main shelter, Families in Transition New Horizons. For the first time ever, they have capped the number of individuals who can go in that shelter. It's about 130 during winter months. It's going to decrease in the summer. I'm extremely grateful. Again, through our Emergency Operations Center, we worked and we brought the faith-based community involved. And Pastor John Rivera is taking people in at Hope Tabernacle during extremely cold nights. So we've been able to go out, the outreach team, the fire department, to where we know the encampments are and make sure that people are not outside and are getting shelter during extremely cold nights. But the nights that are not extremely cold, we don't have places for them. And that was my point earlier. There are very, very few emergency shelter beds throughout the state of New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm. If you walk around Manchester, you may see signs that say, you know, your generosity to folks who are asking for money may cause harm and therefore give to a nonprofit. Is there any indication that those signs are encouraging the kind of behavior you want to encourage?
I'm not sure necessarily if the signs are, but we are working on a communication to do something similar to that. So educating our community and other communities about the programs that we have in place for individuals who are without a home, and that if individuals want to give, and we know, as I mentioned earlier, our community is so giving, that their money is better spent when they give it to a nonprofit who is expert at helping people. Our goal is to get people who are on the street or on a sidewalk or in an area living outside to get into Fit New Horizons, because we have health care for the homeless there. We have LADACs there that can help with addiction. We have Manchester Mental Health there. We have the state there sometimes. So we could wrap individuals with help, with services they need, but we need to get them into the shelter. And by providing them with money or with food that will allow them to stay outside longer, that's not helping them.
Well, we have to leave it there, but I do want to thank you, Mayor Joyce Craig, for being on the program today. We really appreciate you taking the time to talk about City of Manchester.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
And this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. And we're going to stay with Manchester now and listen to a story I produced along with All Things Considered intern producer Alex McCohen. In the basement of St. Anne St. Augustine Church in Manchester, class is in session. About two dozen people, mostly immigrants to New Hampshire, gather around tables to learn English as a second language. 28-year-old Mariam Sulama came to the U.S. from Burkina Faso about 5 years ago, speaking French and not knowing much about life in the U.S.
I learn everything here. Yeah, the father also helped us to learn and to have everything here to write, to read. Yeah, I like that.
The father she refers to is Father Sam Fuller. He's a Capuchin friar and church leader, and he's been a champion of the church's programs for immigrants in the Manchester area, programs to help with issues like housing, health care, and employment.
We've had the chief of police here talk to their population. We're having a workshop on TPS, temporary protective status. This is a huge issue.
But recently, the friars stunned the immigrants they serve by announcing they'd be leaving the Manchester church. They say there aren't enough friars in the region, so a multi-state realignment means these friars will be reassigned elsewhere. Fuller says he's optimistic the services for immigrants will continue, but he says he's aware that these programs remain in what he calls the crosshairs. You've described this church as being in the crosshairs. Can you explain why you would describe it that way?
Well, we have the largest community is Hispanic, and quite a few are undocumented. I mean, we have 11 million undocumented in the United States. It's no secret. So this parish is home to many, many refugees and immigrants. They come here looking for a church, and they hear about St. Anne's Augustine, and they welcome to come here. So we have quite a few undocumented here.
Mm-hmm. And when you say someone is looking at you through the crosshairs, who is that? Is that the government or?
Well, you know, the national conversation is pretty horrendous. What can I say? We all know it. It's heartbreaking. It's more than heartbreaking. It's horrible. And so the fear is palpable in our own parishioners here. And the tearing of the fabric of community is palpable and heart-wrenching. Again, we've had many families who've been impacted directly, being deported. And it's tearing, well, as a Catholic priest, it's tearing at the body of Christ.
And the friars have done quite a bit for immigrant communities, Hispanic communities. Can I ask you about a few of these programs that you've been doing?
Oh, yeah.
Maybe the Granite State Organizing Project? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, just to say, from the beginning, we've been involved with supporting the immigrants, whether the Tyson meat plant, which closed, particularly we had many African parishioners who were there. Once they pulled out, we stepped up the plate, insisted on severance pay and training for other jobs. The bed bug, there's a big bed bug crisis here in Manchester. We had a friar directly involved in that. And so we've had a long history of working to advocate for the basic rights of our parishioners. And so, of course, with the current administration, the immigration issue came to the fore. And so we had to step up the plate. These are complex issues and also heart-wrenching. When a family all of a sudden has a loved one who that day just goes off to work, a normal, seemingly normal day going to work, and they get, and then he's seized and he lands in jail over in Stafford County Jail in Dover. And so so the issues became complex, and we realized we needed to have a place where people could come, not simply for immigration issues, but simply for their own needs, whether translation or any questions they might have. So that's when we formed the Central Latino just over a year ago, and we continue to expand that. Mm-hmm. By having, I mean, we're having workshops too for flower arrangement. You know, it's not just political, it's just building community.
So how do you see these programs, the partnership with the Granite State Organizing Project, the Centro Latino de Hospitalidad, how are those going to continue without the friars here?
That's a good question. And I know there's a great deal of concern about that. As important as the friars might be, we also realize it's not dependent on one individual. It is multifaceted. But there's no question about it. We as friars have been a key part of that. What is the future? We don't know, but we hope that it continues. We have to realize that this is a community outreach. It's integral to the community. We just have to build on that, mm-hmm. and that's the best we can hope for.
So where are the friars going? Where are you going?
We don't know. You know, our whole province is actually under some difficult times. We just announced we're closing a second parish outside New York City on Long Island, and we're also closing a major ministry, Capuchin Youth Family Ministries. We're not closing it, but we're selling the property and the facility to collaborate with another group of friars. So we don't know. We have our chapter the end of May in Hartford, Connecticut. We have it every 3 years, but believe me, no one knows. You have to wait for a chapter and see where the cards land, and then we have discussions as a province.
Well, Father Sam Fuller, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Sure, pleasure. Thank you, Peter.
Capuchin Friar Sam Fuller of Manchester speaking to me earlier this week. Thanks to intern producer Alex McCohen for helping me with that story. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. And still to come, a chat with Sierra Hubbard of the Keene Sentinel about cuts to Monadnock United Way and what that means for area nonprofits. We'll also speak with NHPR's managing editor Corey Princell about how NHPR's newsroom has been going about covering the coronavirus. If you have questions or comments about how you think NHPR or the media as a whole should cover infectious diseases like COVID-19, give us a call now. We'd love to bring you into the conversation when it starts. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also email exchange at nhpr.org. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Several nonprofit agencies in the Monadnock region are facing some difficult decisions after the Monadnock United Way announced major funding cuts last month. Monadnock United Way announced it would be cutting more than $240,000 in support for nonprofit agencies in the region. I spoke yesterday with Keene Sentinel reporter Sierra Hubbard about the story. Can you talk a little bit about this decision by Monadnock United Way? What led to these cuts?
So the Monadnock United Way sent out a letter to the community and explained that basically their funding campaign or fundraiser was down from what they expected. They were down by just over $230,000. They had hoped that they would hit about $1.5 million for 2020, and they only ended up with about $1.3 million. And because of that shortfall, they had to cut allocations to nonprofit agencies, and not only cut allocations, but cut off a lot of agencies from receiving future Monadnock United Way funding.
So how many local nonprofit agencies are affected by this?
Their allocations are divided out by programs. And so there's actually 22 programs at more than a dozen different agencies that will no longer be funded after April. There's also, of the agencies that are continuing to get funding from the Monadnock United Way, a lot of those did receive some cuts as well.
Okay. And what types of services are we talking about that will be affected?
A lot of these are services that were addressing substance use. There's a Cheshire Housing Collaborative, and that is still going to get funding. It's one that just got a 5% funding, but that's one that addresses homelessness. So these are a lot of services that affect vulnerable populations. And basically, the United Way came out and said that, you know, because of this, we're going to decide to focus on really highly targeted initiatives that are related to children and families, emergency housing, food access, and early childhood success. And so they decided to focus on that. So a lot of the other programs that we're looking at, seniors, that we're looking at, again, kind of going back to substance use, mental health, a lot of those programs are the ones that are being cut.
One immediate effect of this cut was the announcement that Big Brothers Big Sisters announced it was laying off a local program coordinator and closing its Keene office. What does this mean for that organization?
They came out and announced that they would have to make that office closure. And essentially, they've explained that while the site-based program will continue, and they did say that some of the Big Brothers and Big Sisters may have to withdraw from some of the schools. So there will be an effect. They are saying, you know, it's not as if Big Brothers and Big Sisters is completely, you know, leaving the area and that service is going to be gone completely, but there won't be any more as many opportunities for, you know, one-on-one follow-up and that kind of a thing in terms of in-person because that office here in Keene is gone. So some of those opportunities that existed before for more of those in-person services won't exist anymore in Keene.
And what's been the reaction from these agencies? Were they surprised by this?
In talking to a lot of these directors and agencies, a lot of them explained that they had an understanding that funding was declining at the Nanak United Way and that, you know, fundraising was going down over the years. And so they had kind of a general understanding that this could happen. But for most of them, the actual cuts coming this year when it did, that seemed to be a surprise for most of them. And so while some were making some adjustments and trying to at least wean themselves off of the United Way funding, the hard cutoff after April came as a surprise to most of them.
I see. So what are the next steps? Do these places have any other places to turn?
A lot of them are talking about, you know, looking for other funding sources. A lot of the people I talked about turning to the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation, who someone said does have an eye on what's going on here, and then trying to, you know, support the agencies here. So they talked about that. They talked about looking for other opportunities in the community, also looking at grants. One thing that was discussed is that, you know, there could be some difficulty in that now all of a sudden you have all of these agencies, you know, that will be turning to the community looking for donations and contributions to make up what they've lost. And so that could make for a difficult environment in terms of fundraising, more difficult than fundraising already is. Another piece of this is that the city of Keene, as part of its budget process, has contributions to what they call outside agencies, which are nonprofits. And there's already been at least one counselor who has expressed, you know, some concern over maybe we should start talking about this. These nonprofits might make larger requests from the city to make up for this. So there's definitely, you know, a lot of discussion about what do we do next.
Sierra Hubbard, reporter with the Keene Sentinel, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
If you've been listening to public radio at all this week, you know that the coronavirus and COVID-19 is the big story this week. Here at NHPR, we've been thinking a lot about how to cover it and what information is most important. In the studio with us now is NHPR's managing editor, Corey Princel. She's here to talk about how NHPR's newsroom has approached covering the coronavirus. Corey, thank you very much for being here.
Sure.
So it's here in New Hampshire, coronavirus, two cases confirmed. What has the newsroom's response been to covering this story?
I mean, it's just amazing to think about how much has happened just in 1 week. I was remembering when we started the week, we had the fourth person being tested, and then later that morning, we found out it was the first positive test. So it was actually that day we had previously planned to have a meeting to sort of discuss how we were going to be covering this going forward. And by the time we had that meeting in the afternoon, it was like, oh, this is feeling really serious. So we had a lot of people in the room. We had our digital director, Rebecca Lavoie. We had a producer for The Exchange, Christina Phillips, Jason Moon, our health reporter, Todd Bookman, who'd been covering it. And we also invited Taylor Quimby, who's our producer and host of Patient Zero, which is about Lyme disease, but he's become kind of our resident epidemiology expert. So, and our news director was there. So we just talked about kind of like how do we want to cover this in a way that informs people, provides useful information, doesn't add to any sense of alarm. And I think one of the first things we realized is we wanted to connect with our listeners and find out what their concerns were, what their experiences are. So we put up a survey a listener survey, and that went up on Monday. And at this point, we have over 50 questions and responses on that survey. So, and we welcome people to continue sending us questions and thoughts there.
What kind of questions are people asking?
Oh, just questions like what are the signs of like, you know, people, some people have written in with some of the symptoms that they have and concerns they, you know, what should I do next? Is the state fully prepared? What do I do about my travel? We got a lot of questions early on about what self-quarantine means, because we heard from people early on who had like gotten back from Italy even before the CDC had raised and actually made it a requirement that you self-quarantine coming back from Italy and three other countries. Some people who were doing it at that point just sort of voluntarily. And well, what does it mean to self-quarantine at home? How do you do, like, can you, is it, if you're staying at home, can your family members go out? Is that safe? And we've learned a lot more since then, sort of the difference between self-isolation when you know you have a confirmed case, or just self-quarantine when you're being extra careful and staying home for those 14 days. It is okay for family members to come and go, as long as the person staying home is very careful about sort of using their own bathroom and kind of, you know, paying attention to their space.
So if listeners have more questions or questions they haven't heard answered elsewhere, how do they reach out to NHPR through this survey? Would we call it a survey?
Yeah. I mean, it's really easy to find, nhpr.org/coronavirus. And we've got all of our coverage there on that page. We have a prominent link to the survey. We also have an FAQ that we'll continue to update as, because information is changing every day, and we're updating both a daily blog and that FAQ.
So nhpr.org/coronavirus.
Right.
You know a story is serious when you have just one word after the slash. If given to all the stories in a particular kind of theme. And along that, I mean, you mentioned that you're trying to find the balance between informing people but not unduly alarming people. How do you do that? I mean, when you can say so many times, wash your hands, don't touch your face, wash your hands, don't touch your face. But if you keep saying that so much, it sounds alarming, right?
Yeah. I mean, we're definitely mindful of that. I mean, that's partly why we've presented a lot of the information in a blog format, to show that, you know, there are a lot of just kind of small updates. And, you know, maybe another person is being tested. Maybe another person is being monitored. And if you lead with that as your headline, it might make you feel, oh, no, another person's being monitored. But if you include that among all the other news that's coming out in this, like, rapidly changing situation that involves a lot of uncertainty, that's one way we're doing it. And also just doing a little bit of newscast that captures kind of ordinary life and the decisions people are making. Like, we had newscast earlier this week of a woman at the Concord Coach bus terminal who had decided to go ahead with her trip to Florida, and but she was going to wipe down her tray table and wipe down the seatbelt on the plane. And so just to hear some of that normalcy of how people are negotiating this, you know, this potential threat and their fears, but continuing on to travel domestically. So, you know, conveying some of how people are moving through life is one way that you can kind of minimize that sense of alarm.
So what kind of angles are NHPR reporters taking when covering the coronavirus?
I mean, one thing that we talked about in that first planning meeting that's definitely on our minds are questions about how, you know, depending on where this goes, how it could affect different groups of people differently. You know, when you have like a strong social network and people who could maybe help out if say schools were closed and your kids had to stay home, people who are in the position to be able to work remotely, it's going to look very different if your job requires you to be someplace in person interacting with lots of other people. You know, there are some people who have the means to go to Target and buy lots of food and supplies. Some people can't afford to do that.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. This is, of course, an issue that goes beyond New Hampshire's borders. COVID-19 doesn't just stop at a state line. How is NHPR working with other stations across New England or NPR to further the coverage of coronavirus?
We've got close relationships with all the other stations in New England through the New England News Collaborative. And early on, we set up, you know, we do a lot of things on Slack now. So we've got a coronavirus Slack channel where we share our stories, we share resources, we share ideas. Earlier this week when we were getting a lot of questions, actually people, you know, nationwide were asking about this question of self-quarantine. What does it mean? How do you do it? WBUR in Boston put together a nice feature where they talked with some experts about just how you go about doing that. So we aired that story. And so that's one thing we're doing. As far as working with NPR, I've been on a couple of conference calls with NPR editors and reporters this week. They're opening up themselves to reporters for at stations across the country who are seeing this in different ways based on where they are. And so we're sharing story ideas with each other across the country, getting advice from NPR editors about things like, you know, everything from, you know, how do you refer to this new coronavirus, to like, you know, workplace safety issues and how is NPR guiding their reporting staff that's, you know, all over the world to make sure that they stay safe.
Mm-hmm. What are some, if any, long-term projects that NHPR is working on or something that a story goal that you're hoping to achieve, information that you're hoping to get out there, things you want to hear from listeners perhaps? Is there anything out there, anything around the bend that we should be looking for when it comes to coverage of the coronavirus?
It's like we don't really know even where we're going to be with this next week. I think we just want to keep in touch with our audience. We want to keep hearing from people. We really want to capture. We want to make sure, like I said, we want our reporting to be really useful to our audience. Like we really want to make sure that we're telling people what they need to know. But we also want to capture the experience of this. So I mean, I can't speculate on what those stories are going to be. We just want to make sure that we're looking at this in a broad way.
NHPR's managing editor, Corey Princel, thank you very much for giving us an update on how we're covering the coronavirus. Really appreciate it.
Sure.
And this has been the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. Really appreciate you listening today. Remember, the conversation about everything we've talked about today continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. The show's producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brindley is our program manager, who had a big hand in today's show. Our regular theme music was composed by Bob Lord. Special thanks today to All Things Considered producer Alex McGowan for help with so many of the interviews I've done this week and for doing a little Spanish-English translation during our reporting this week with immigrants in Manchester. Multi-talented, that one. The engineer is Dan Colgan. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.